This podcast is sponsored by Kaplan Professional, the leading provider of online education for Australia's finance industry. Studying my Master of Applied Finance with Kaplan Professional provided me with the flexibility and support to deepen my specialist knowledge while balancing my professional commitments. If you're planning to sit the CFA exam, Kaplan Professional is also renowned for the most respected preparation materials in the industry. Visit kaplanprofessional.edu.au to learn more. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the RASC Group's Financial Services Guide on the RASC Finance website. Emmanuel Datt is the Managing Director of the Datt Family Office and Datt Capital, a relatively new investment management company based in Melbourne. In this episode, we discuss Emmanuel's early life and growing up with two entrepreneurial parents. His mother was a general practitioner, while his father owned and operated a motel and invested heavily in commercial property. Emmanuel talks at length about his earliest successes and failures in markets, the psychology of investing, a major ASX-listed technology investment, lending large sums of money to property developers, and running a multi-asset portfolio. Please enjoy this episode with Emmanuel Datt of Datt Capital. Emmanuel, thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks, Owen.
Perhaps you can cast your mind back to when you were a youngster and your parents were running two businesses. It's my understanding your father was in tourism with a motel, and your mother was a general practitioner.
Yes, correct. I guess, I grew up in a fairly middle-class sort of family. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, my mother was a GP with her own practice. And my father obviously was in motel operator and also did commercial property type plays here and there. And I think one particular aspect that is very, I guess, relevant to this conversation is just seeing from a very young age the type of work hours and work ethic that they put in. For example, I always remember, my mother worked Saturday mornings and, my dad did as well. Mm. And so Saturday was almost like another work day for us. And, we'd obviously help out here and there where we could. Sunday was obviously the day of rest, so we always look forward to Sundays. But I always remember that being really interested in the conversations that my father used to have with, his friends and, at social events when they talk about various investments and business propositions that always held. I always really enjoyed listening to, the adults speak about those sort of opportunities and, how they were doing their investments and all that sort of thing. So I guess that in retrospect, is where my interest may have been sparked in the financial and investment space.
Were they self-made? Were your parents, they started these businesses?
Yes. So my father immigrated to Australia when he was 20 years old, and my mother followed a couple of years behind him once they got married. Yeah, so they were very much self-made. My mother worked in, hospitals and all sorts of medical facilities before.
So she was a doctor before she came out?
Yes, she'd done medical school, but okay. She'd worked sort of extensively. They lived in regional areas for some time as well, in Benalla, so she was working in hospitals and doing locums and that sort of type of work. Mm-hmm. And my father obviously was involved in tourism in the regional areas as well. Pretty much the same capacity. And when they moved back to Melbourne, then they decided to set up in Hoppers Crossing, which is in the western suburbs of Melbourne. And it was not really considered part of metropolitan Melbourne at the time that they moved there, but they saw the opportunity to set up a sort of GP practice and for my father to commute to to the big, you know, city for work. And
so yeah. The GP clinic came first?
It was around the same time. I think it may have been slightly after, by maybe 4 or 5 months, something like that.
Okay. Basically. Two businesses pretty much from scratch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, from the hospital, the tourism side, my father had some partners that were involved in the business at the time, and sort of gradually they were bought out.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds like they were very entrepreneurial, you know, they're willing to take the risk.
Yeah.
Did that ever... Do you think that wore off on you? Did you ever have any entrepreneurial tendencies as a youngster?
Not particularly, but I always remembered hearing, you know, my father and mother telling me stories of when they first got married and they were living in Melbourne, out in Oakley, how, you know, they'd buy up houses in Richmond in the Cremorne area, which was considered very blue-collar at that time.
So, not today.
Not today, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I remember my father sort of, you know, when we'd drive through there, he'd be like, oh, you know, me and your mum renovated that house. We, you know, bought it for 10 grand and we sold it for 14 or something like that, gave it a splash of paint. And, you know, so I think that was obviously before they had kids. So, you know, it was a happy period of their life when they were renovating or doing little renovations on house properties and flipping them over for a bit of cash. So I think that was quite, you know, it made an impression on me that, you know, there are many ways to sort of earn a dollar. It's just about applying yourself and using your head.
It's interesting. I would assume that your mother being a GP and your father having his own business, that that would consume much of their time and their effort. And it would hopefully also be quite lucrative. But then to have all these businesses or projects on the side, I should say, yeah, I suppose that adds a totally new dynamic to your understanding of money.
Yes, yes, I think so. And I think also we were raised in a very frugal environment. So, you know, we never got pocket money, for example. We had to justify or convince them why we should get them to purchase something for us. And, yeah, we were sort of expected to help out, do our chores, all that sort of thing. So,
would you receive... So when you say justify, can you draw on any examples of, you know, would you say, I want to get into the cinemas or something like that? Or
yeah, pretty much. So when I was younger, cinemas were a fairly special event, so they were quite rare. But I think it's more the fact that, you know, we were sort of, you know, sometimes you see kids today, they get pocket money, you know, because they're doing chores, for example. But that was never sort of the case. In my household, it was more an expectation that, you know, you're part of the family, you have to help out. And, yeah, I think that sort of attitude flowed through.
Yeah. Okay. One thing you did mention to me in a previous conversation is that your parents, one thing that they, I suppose, were more than willing to spend on was your education. Reflecting on that now, do you think that was a worthwhile investment? And maybe you could just describe where you went to school.
Yeah, sure. So basically, I attended private school my entire life. So I attended primary school at a school called Westbourne Grammar, which is in Harpers Crossing. I attended high school at Melbourne Grammar, which is just in South Yarra. And I felt it was a good experience because of the emphasis on learning, and I suppose provided a good environment to try and fulfill, you know, whatever the potential was in, you know, a child or kid. Yeah, I feel that it was quite beneficial because it was a well-rounded education. It wasn't just purely academic. So we're always, sports was mandatory, for example, but so were sort of art classes, and, you know, you, it gave you a broad range of experiences, which I found really beneficial, even in terms of learning languages. You know, I've been learning various languages since prep. I'm not really sure if that was typical for the time versus a public school. I know public schools today obviously have that same emphasis, but I felt it was a very beneficial educational experience.
So they didn't have any, I suppose, plans for you to become a doctor, following your mother's footsteps?
Yes. Well, the first 18 years of my life, I had the impression that I would, that was what I, the path I wanted to pursue in life. My mother's side of the family were mostly in the medical profession. as doctors and various, you know, specialities mm-hmm. they practiced. So I felt it was my calling at the time as well. And I suppose as I got older, I realized the length of the educational process in following a medical career in Australia itself. And I realized that it was maybe not the path that I wanted to follow. I always had the example of my mother as a GP and being a very sort of selfless, caring person towards you know, her patients. I think at the time I felt that I couldn't quite live up to that as well. You know, I felt it wasn't necessarily suited to my personality, I think, at the time.
That sounds reasonable to me. So then you went and became, or you went to university to study?
Yes. So then I attended Deakin University. I pursued an arts and commerce degree. I ended up, and at the time during uni, I was also working in the family businesses.
What were you doing?
I was managing, in the early days, I was managing my mother's medical practice to a large degree. And also in the hotel side, I was basically doing menial sort of work initially. And then sort of over time, I graduated towards to the back office and started keeping the books and, you know, being more involved on the business side.
That's great. So you had your apprenticeship dealing with customers and the community.
Exactly, yeah. And I felt that was quite valuable in terms of, you know, I feel that I can read people very well now. And both being service industries to a degree, I felt that it was, it gave me a lot of humility in seeing people from all levels of, you know, from all levels socially. And being able to interact with everyone and sort of improve my interpersonal skills, because I was quite a shy kid growing up. Yeah, so I felt that it was, yeah, a very good experience. And, you know, I still use a lot of the skills I picked up, yeah, in my day-to-day life today.
Well, most of us don't have that tangible experience with business, do we? I remember when I was in school, one of the students in my class said his father was in business. That was just a vague term for me. I didn't know what that meant, and yeah, it was totally different for me. So I think that early experience for you, once again, just helps shape you as an investor now, and what I suppose what's required to make things a success. So you've studied at Deakin, and you're fulfilling these managerial roles in your early 20s. How many people were you dealing with? How many people were under
your supervision?
I think
at that stage, I think the entire group had somewhere, I'd say, about the mid-30s, you know, across the board. So, you know, I was dealing with sort of payroll, you know, all sorts of various managerial responsibilities. As an early 20s, yeah. Sort of, it was quite a good experience. And, you know, I learned a lot, because you're dealing with people from the customer side. You're also dealing with your employees and staff, and making sure everyone is happy, working out grievances, and, you know, if there are any. And, yeah, so it was a very rich experience.
The nitty-gritty behind
the
scenes.
Yeah, really at the coalface, I guess, absolutely. Type of work. And, yeah.
Great. So around about, was it 2006, prior to the GFC, if it's my understanding, this is when you started to invest your own money, personally, while you're still working. Can you describe some of the early learnings, some of your successes and failures, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. So I think the very first stock I purchased was ABC Learning Centres, and that was via, I think I'd opened up an IG Markets or a CMC Markets, one of those sort of CFD type accounts with, you know, a very small amount of money, maybe $1,000. And I think I'd read an article in the paper saying that ABC is going to, you know, the stock price will be significantly higher in 6 months or something like that. And, you know, as a uni student at the time, I thought, oh, you know, this sounds like easy money. I might give it a go. And I did that, and it was abject failure. I probably don't need to.
I think most of us know how ABC learning ended.
Yeah. So I think that experience of loss and, you know, $1,000 to me as a uni student was quite significant.
Mm.
And, you know, feeling the personal pain of, you know, making a bad investment, I think that sort of fired me to, you know, work out what I'd done wrong and how I'd done it wrong. Because, you know, academically, I was always very strong. Mm. And I guess I always thought that there was a way to do things in a better way. I always felt that I can justify something intellectually, or, you know, anything can be solved if you approach it the right way or with the right amount of application. And that's sort of the approach I took. I really wanted to find out why I made a loss, essentially. So I did, I guess, a little bit of study into how the markets work, sort of learnt from the ground up. And so when that happened, it was sort of, you know, the very beginning of the uranium boom.
Mm.
After learning sort of the ground, you know, the very basic sort of framework for the markets, you know, I was on a lot of stock market discussion forums at the time, just learning the ropes, I guess you could call it. And I noticed a large uranium mine, Cigar Lake in Canada, had flooded, and that would wipe out a large proportion of uranium production at the time. Right. And so basically, with that knowledge in mind, I thought, okay, the commodity price rise, you know, uranium obviously being a controlled material, you know, there's no ability to really ramp up supply that quickly. So I think I had that knowledge of supply and demand quite young, I suppose, or, you know, I'd picked it up maybe a bit earlier, but it sort of intuitively made sense. Also, you know, stuff you learn in economics at uni or in high school. So it sort of made sense to me intuitively. So, you know, looked through the various uranium companies, made a few investments, and I was quite successful for sort of a year or two. So I managed to run up my sort of savings of, I think it was about 30,000 at the time, ran it up 700% to a bit over 200 grand on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, as I mentioned in the previous interview, that I went away on holidays for a month, had a lovely holiday, and came back and it was cut in half because of, you know, the market correction. So it was a very valuable learning experience, you know, with the acceleration of, you know, making that much money at the time, which was very significant.
How old were you at this time?
I was 23 or 24. And, you know, I think the average salary at the time was somewhere around 40 grand, so it was, you know, it was a big amount at the time
really
for me.
Anyway. Perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. And yeah, so just riding the exhilaration up, but then feeling, you know, the despondency when it came down, even though I was still well ahead of where I'd started, that you know, take off tax and all that sort of thing, and you know, it was a really probably major, one of the key learning experiences for me.
The uranium price at the time was just seemed no end to it. I think it hit about $140 a pound, and now it's back below $20 or so, I think.
Yes.
It seems that every year since that time, someone's been calling for a uranium boom of some description.
Yeah.
Did you, I suppose, take away anything psychologically, like with your behaviour and your temperament, from that big drawdown?
Yes, I sort of, that taught me about position sizing more than anything, because I was heavily concentrated in these particular uranium stocks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fully invested probably across maybe three or four stocks, and they were all related to the uranium sector. So the correlation between all of them was probably very, very high.
Mm.
And so that taught me quite a lot about diversification and, I guess, holding uncorrelated positions.
I'm interested to know how you got to that initial $30,000 to invest while you're at uni.
Yeah, well, this is a particularly strong memory for me. I remember having saved about $2,000 by the time I left high school. And throughout probably the first 2 years of university, I was working part-time, earning, you know, a small amount. I think at that time I was earning maybe a couple hundred bucks a week working part-time. And but I realized that I think it must have been the second or third, at the end of the second or third year of university, I looked at my bank account and I thought, you know, I had this amount of money, you know, at the time I left high school. And it was really a big shock to me in a way. I'd been enjoying university life a little too much, spending on things that I didn't need or, you know, particularly care for, I guess, after some time, or I wasn't being careful enough with my money. But that experience really made me think about what I was spending on. And so over time, I'd managed to sort of saved up my earnings and build it up to about 30 grand. And that's sort of where I got my initial stake to invest in, just by being a little bit disciplined about, you know, not maybe buying that extra drink or at the university bar, or, you know, just cutting out, you know, the expenses that were luxuries in retrospect.
It's funny how we can make those tweaks to our spending, and before we know it, that's snowballed into something which can lead to, in this case, life-changing in effect, because you were able to use that money later on to invest.
Yes. And yeah, maybe it was part of my frugal upbringing that it had to come out somewhere, that, you know, I felt I maybe, you know, needed to spend money to feel happy, but I realized that it didn't really provide happiness. And that, yeah, a bit of common sense went a long way in the end.
That's interesting. We always, when we're young, we seek abundance, and we, you know, we collect things, we collect people and friendships and what we think of friendships. But over time, we begin to realise that perhaps it's the opposite. We, you know, we prune our financial our circles of people, and we begin to appreciate what we have in front of us. And I think that's, in a way, it's borne out here in terms of, you know, we spend on these things that we think will make us happy, only to find that they're not. But I imagine this was around the time of the global financial crisis, the GFC, in the lead up to it at least. Were you still investing throughout the GFC?
I was, but to a much smaller degree. I think I'd been... Yeah, psychologically, it took me some time to digest and process, I guess, the loss I'd experienced. And I took, from memory, I monitored the markets, but to a degree, I was afraid, I guess, because, you know, during the GFC period, the market was in a general downtrend for about 18 months from memory. You know, every day there was doom and gloom, you know, from everyone, you know, the media and, you know, people that you spoke to. So I think there was a lot of uncertainty during that particular period of time. And it affected me because I felt, you know, to a degree, riding the, I guess, riding, you know, with my portfolio value, I felt that I was untouchable and I could, you know, I knew everything. And, you know, to have that portfolio value come crashing down, it was really, you know, a wake-up call for me.
So you were, I suppose, put off by this, the emotions, the behavioural biases kicked in here. Do you now look back on that and do you think what an opportunity that was? Or are you still today, do you still believe that that was perhaps the right decision for you at the time?
Yes, I think it was the right decision at the time. I think the right analogy is that the person you are today is the sum of all your prior experiences. So you can't, I wouldn't change anything I've done in retrospect. I think, you know, time was needed to gain that humility in terms of, you know, learning that the market is the master. It's not something that you can influence on an individual level. I felt that it's really helped shape my investment philosophy.
That's a great way to put it. And as always, I personally think that it's better to learn these lessons earlier in life because we have time to recover and adapt and compound that knowledge over time. So this leads us to a difficult time in your life personally and from what I can tell perhaps even financially, which was the passing of your father before you turned 30. And I can imagine if that wasn't hard enough, you've had the family businesses in the background and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the eldest child in the family.
No, I'm the middle child.
Middle child, yeah. Okay. But you have the financial nous and understanding.
Yes.
This was a particularly tough time for your family. Did you feel the weight of responsibility given your, the understanding of finance and to take that role on?
Yes. So I guess part of it is my cultural background. Coming from an Indian background, you know, the culture is generally paternalistic in the sense that, you know, the weight of, I guess, the family expectation typically falls upon the eldest son. I'm the only son in my family. So I guess, you know, from a very young age, I was brought up with a sense of responsibility and the sense that, you know, when my father's gone, I have to sort of take care of my family. And that's something that I was happy to, I guess, bear because I'd been raised like that from a very young age. Also, what comes into it is obviously my education and my financial nous as well.
So it was never a case of why me and throwing your arms up in the air? And
No. So, yeah, I mean, it was just, I guess, at 29, you know, you should be a man. I guess that's what it comes down to, and you should be able to take care of, you know, your loved ones.
I mean, personally, I can only imagine, but to put some context behind this, obviously the businesses, while you're investing and you're still operating parts of the businesses, they're still bubbling away and they're still, you've still got things to do and things to manage. Perhaps you can talk about some of the property investments or the work you were doing on property, your family was doing on property around this time and your role in that.
No problem. My family were typically heavily invested in property, generally pretty highly leveraged. So I think a lot of the family funds were probably used in debt servicing and that sort of thing. But, you know, over time, my father had built up quite a good sizable land holding in Melbourne in an area called Brunswick. And
a trendy suburb nowadays.
That time it was very much sort of unloved, but I guess he could see the potential evident in the location. And so basically it acquired quite a sizable portion of property over time. And so at the time of his death, there were, I guess, a few considerations because, you know, the tourism industry was still in the doldrums from the GFC years. From my perspective, it had been basically unprofitable for, you know, the GFC years up until, you know, maybe 2011, 2012. So
Quite a few years.
Yeah. So it was a lot of years to, I guess, subsidize or just, you know, make a loss just to just to stay you know, in the business. So I guess, you know, I guess you could just call us asset rich but cash poor. I think that's the best way to describe it. Guess at the time, in the time immediately post my father's death, sort of my number one priority was securing my family's financial security. So we'd looked through quite a number of options with the best way to realize that value. We ended up having joint venture discussions with a number of large listed companies and superannuation funds. As I said previously, the land holding was quite substantial, so it was sort of at that sort of scale. And I learned a huge amount about negotiation, dealing with solicitors, accountants, advisors of various sorts, and really how to set up a deal, drive it through. I guess it didn't ultimately come to fruition. But yeah, we ended up putting it on market and selling it. But even that, you know, it was a difficult process to manage. You have to coach, cajole, threaten, push everyone to work in the same direction. From the real estate agents to the solicitors to everyone else. It was a big job to do.
Mm.
But ultimately it all worked out well. And
were the suitors for the property, were they seeking to develop it? Brunswick's fairly inner city, we can probably call that today.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to put a hotel or apartments or something on there?
Yes. So we had sort of been working quite hard on the planning aspects of the site as well, which is, I guess one other aspect of the work I was doing at the background. So, but I think it was a very educational period for me because it really gave me the chops to evaluate commercial property, you know, very quickly and very easily.
Mm.
My attitude has always been to really know about opportunities and the laws around the planning framework, the legal framework, all the constraints around particular opportunities intimately, and you don't necessarily need to advertise that to everyone. And I found that has worked really well because you can really get a you can really evaluate people if you go in pretending not to know anything about a particular opportunity and seeing what they actually say about it, when in reality you may know just as much or even more than they do, and seeing how they try and pitch it to you. So I felt that has really worked to our advantage, especially of late.
I find that an interesting idea. Often when people introduce themselves to me and they talk about, be their financial advisor or something of that description, I generally keep it to myself that I'm also in the financial industry, and it's very interesting to see how they describe what they do to a beginner, and it allows you, I suppose, some insight into them as a person, and I suppose their ability to convey complex messages. And I find that very interesting that you also use that as a litmus test, I suppose, when you're seeking out these professionals and their opinion.
But it really, I guess, one thing I should add is it's really shaped the way we operate in terms of, we are very transparent with allies, I guess you could call it, and people that, other sort of individuals or other family offices that we work with. We're very open, transparent, collaborative. You know, we don't try and, I guess, be deceptive in any sort of sense. Because ultimately we try and treat people the way we want to be treated.
I think that's really important. It's there's plenty of instances where we can all recall there's been some element of deception in our industry. I'm interested because you've mentioned something to me previously about you when you were selling this property, you were lobbying government. I'm interested to know how you did that, and because that's obviously so foreign to me and I suppose to a lot of our listeners, how you would go about that and what you were trying to achieve there.
So basically we were trying to achieve planning certainty for the site. It was a really large scale type development, or it had the potential to be very large scale. At the time of our initial concept, it was I think the scheme we'd put together was somewhere between 400 or 500 apartments at the at that particular time. And so that involved, we'd hired, the best planning consultant that we felt was at the time and that we could afford. So it involved going around to various, to the local government authority, the council, and also various departments at state government level. I remember having being involved in a lunch with the planning minister at the time and pitching him that, can you help us out?
About getting in front of these people.
And just really sort of hustling to get some planning certainty around it. So, I remember, just doing whatever it took to you know, get my foot in the door at the time. And I think that's, you know, what our approach. You can really go places and get into places which you never dreamed existed if you, you know, hustle and be creative in the ways that you, you know, approach things.
And if you're motivated to do it, correct, you can do it. Yeah. This was around about leading up to 2016, and the property successfully sells at a valuation more than what you had previously been offered or be valued at. Can you give us any very rough idea of, I mean, if it's a few hundred apartments, can you give us any rough idea of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So our assets under management within our own family office are sort of in the region of the mid-eight figures. And that's not including our external fund, which we have just started to take on external investors.
Okay.
Yeah.
This, for me personally, if I was to be in your situation, and I was to come into a what you could call a liquidity event like this, I might feel compelled at least to entertain the idea of potentially outsourcing some of the investing to fund managers or whoever they may be. You, from what I can tell, appear to have gone the other way and taken the responsibility on yourself to, to start a family office which you now run. Can you explain why, I suppose, you started the DAT family office?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose a lot of it comes down to one thing I neglected to mention before was that I pursued a master's in applied finance. That was sort of, you know, in the post-GFC period. And I felt that was very beneficial. I did that more because I felt I had a long-term interest in the space and that I wanted to be very strong technically and have a very strong, you know, technical grounding in finance itself, but, you know, with the applied bent, I would say, not just learning theory, but things that I could use practically. And I felt that was really, really beneficial to me personally. I guess at the time, of the period post the liquidity event, we'd sort of looked at various investment options or managers, and we felt that there was what was lacking in the market was, you know, a principal-led fund, I suppose, that was sort of multi-asset. Existing multi-asset funds, you know, provided very poor returns, sort of, you know, in the low to single to mid single digits.
Can I ask you what you mean by principal-led?
In terms of having a CIO or a portfolio manager who had a significant portion of their wealth in the fund.
So that alignment, it was what was lacking.
Exactly. Yeah. So that basically obtained the majority of their returns via their own investment in the fund. Yeah. But obviously in a multi-asset or, and multi-strategy type context.
Okay. Just to give some context to readers, a family office typically has a large pool of money. There's maybe accountants or people that play a role in the background. And then you have investment specialists taking care of that money. So is there some degree, I suppose, of control that gives you around tax planning, those types of things as well?
Yes, yes. So we have our own staff. We typically outsource, you know, the major, you know, legal, accounting, that sort of thing. And, but we have, you know, our own investment team and, you know, administrative reporting team, internally. I suppose, with the principal led, having a member of the family, you know, I guess driving, the investments, there's no, question of agency, issues, which obviously a big factor, you know. I think incentives are very powerful, and you know, they have to be aligned basically, but I felt that removed that entire, I guess, dilemma, you could call it. So yeah,
because it's not always the case that the person who's overseeing the family office is also, you know, part of the family. Oftentimes you'll have chief investment officers that have spent time in a funds management business and then come across.
Correct.
One of the things that you've said to me previously, and what I've read in some of the commentary that you provided, is you target a 10 to 12% annualized return.
Mm-hmm.
Was that from the beginning, from the get-go with the family offices, was that your target? And I suppose, why was that your target?
That was our target primarily because we felt it was achievable without a high degree of risk. And I suppose, you know, that would be a blended rate across multiple assets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've achieved a little bit under 12.5% over the sort of previous 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, you know, with the 25% average cash weighting. So we try and be very sort of selective with the investments that we sort of participate in.
Mm-hmm.
And that we invest in the opportunities. So I think it's probably unrealistic to target, for example, 20% in a multi-asset context, unless the markets are, you know, really good
at
a particular point, or coming off a very sort of low point. Like, for example, the post GFC period, you could probably obtain those sort of returns, but I felt it was a achievable return throughout the cycles. Yeah,
And that's might say that's quite impressive to achieve that type of return with across multi assets, and by that we mean derivatives, fixed interest, equities or shares, and debt.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, in 2018, you decided to launch a managed fund vehicle alongside the family office.
Yes.
And essentially allowing outside investors to come on board.
Yes.
Why was that the case?
I felt that that was a niche that was missing in the current market offering.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that if we could design a product that we'd invest in ourselves, then there'd be other investors or market participants that would find the product useful. So that, I guess, is the core of it. I suppose also the fact that I'm relatively young, I'm 35 at the moment, and I've got a long road ahead of me, I think, in this space. So I felt that rather than just being happy and comfortable, investing my own family's assets, I felt that it was a new challenge. And one where I could provide value to other investors.
In my experience, at least, it's when an investor approaches it in that regard, in such a way that it's really their own wealth that they're managing, but they allow outside investors. That can tend to lend itself to, you know, a better experience for investors. Mm. Can you explain to listeners how you manage the money from a very high level, that bird's eye view? And I'm particularly interested, which we'll drill down to in just a moment, but the commercial debt part of the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So can you provide that bird's eye view for us?
Sure. So typically we source our debt through a wide variety of syndicators that we have relationships with.
Mm-hmm.
For those who are unfamiliar, a syndicate is a collection of investors basically investing in the same facility.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a commercial property owner might need a $10 million first mortgage facility, and for whatever reason he may not want to deal with the bank, or they might have exposure limits within their primary banking partner, and they just want a mortgage done, or so a refinance done quickly. So
this would be like a property developer that wants to put up.
Yeah, or it could be even a yield type investor that owns an office building, for example.
Yeah.
So a syndicate is basically, just say that $10 million might be split up again between 5 or 10 different investors that each take a piece. So we found that approach to be quite beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of diversifying our risk without, so it sort of spreads your risk across multiple assets and locations, projects, all that sort of thing. So I felt that model works quite well in the space.
it probably sits within your wheelhouse, within your circle of competence, right? You know,
correct,
you said to me previously, yeah, you got your master's in commercial property.
Oh, applied finance.
But you got the practical experience, yeah, that master's
exactly
degree, if you
yeah,
like.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So it's probably right in your wheelhouse. So you combined that exposure with equities or shares, fixed mm-hmm interest,
yeah,
and even some derivatives.
Mm.
Can you explain, I suppose, why you invest in with a multi-asset strategy? Like why did you design a portfolio sure like that?
Yeah, so basically, I guess an analogy, Owen, is we consider that real estate debt to be like an illiquid form of fixed interest, essentially, mm-hmm, which is what it is. But you know, for a investor, they can take upon particular risks, one being credit risk, equity, illiquidity, and leverage. Mm-hmm. So we deal obviously in the first three risks, and you just need to make sure you're getting paid for that risk ultimately, mm, the risk that you take on.
Mm.
From the multi-asset side of things, you know, diversifying across the asset classes was quite important to us because we wanted to be defensive in our outlook, and you know, we invest according to first principles, mm, across the whole capital structure. So I think for us not investing in a multi, you know, taking a multi-asset approach, it's just like removing all the tools from your toolbox.
Mm.
But yeah, so it just was something that worked intuitively. You know, it made sense to me intuitively.
Yeah, with your experience and
yeah,
given it's your family's money, that's how you would invest it. Yeah,
correct, yeah.
You touched on something there, leverage or gearing.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't use any type of leverage into your positions?
No sort of gearing or leverage at all.
And that's simply risk?
Yeah, well, I guess by not using leverage, it makes your carrying capacity much more robust. You're not subject to margin calls or, you know, the whims of external parties, I suppose.
Mm.
And you can really hold positions with conviction,
mm-hmm,
if you have a strong conviction, that is, yeah.
Mm. Okay. I suppose what we're looking for as investors is that asymmetric return profile. Yeah. We want to limit our downside and mm-hmm have as much upside as possible. And yeah, there's some arguments to be made that perhaps pure gearing or leverage mm-hmm doesn't provide that. It just magnifies whatever you already have.
Mm.
But you do use, I suppose, a bit more of an exotic strategy, if you can call it that.
Mm-hmm.
You do use derivatives and, yeah, I suppose, a systematic approach to some types of investing across your portfolio. Can you explain how you use derivatives?
And yeah, sure.
Yeah, whether they're used for risk or potential return?
Sure. So conceptually, I say conceptually because we're still sort of in the process of implementing our derivative strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, we are systematic in the sense that we're trying to obtain yield from the strategy, but not be subject to the long tail risk, essentially. So we sort of combine short volatility positions and long volatility positions, but we're always net long.
Yep.
So if another GFC event occurs, then those positions will provide sort of the asymmetric outcomes.
Mm, yeah, it's somewhat downside protection there.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And you and I got talking over Twitter,
mm-hmm,
and we've since had some really good conversations on there, albeit with limited characters.
Yeah.
Another point of differentiation is, I suppose, your weighting into equity positions, so share positions on the ASX.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to listeners and to myself what you're looking for when you're making these investments?
We look for a lot of things, to be honest. We have various buckets that we, I guess, silos that you could, there's probably a better description,
mm-hmm,
that we particularly interest us.
Perhaps
I guess
you could use an example.
Yeah.
And describe what you like about the position or.
Sure, sure. Say, for example, you know, I think it's pretty clear to people that follow us that we really like Afterpay.
Mm-hmm.
As an opportunity, we feel that for a lot of reasons. You know, we feel that the growth path ahead is immense. You know, the opportunity at hand,
mm-hmm,
and we think it ticks all the boxes, you know, from the management team to the structure of the markets themselves to the technology. It's all, yeah, it's all there for us, basically. Mm. We feel that perhaps the local market isn't valuing the opportunity the same way it might be valued in the US. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we found that was very interesting was the entrance of Berkshire Hathaway, that's run by Warren Buffett, who is the epitome of a value investor, and their investment into an Indian payments platform that they valued at, I think they purchased their equity for about a $10 billion valuation overall.
Well,
but saying that, you know, it's, you know, the clarity around the company financials isn't that clear because it's a private company. So I felt that that was almost a paradigm shift in terms of, you know, for a prominent value investor to invest in these payment platform companies. I felt that, you know, Afterpay itself is a very strong and it's a viral platform, payment platform. So that sort of has really added conviction to you know, our sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Around the company.
Afterpay seems like quite a convincing case. It tends to polarise people, but I'm interested to know how big the size of the investment is, I suppose, in percentage terms or broad terms, and why you have such a conviction and why you concentrate the portfolio the way you do.
So Afterpay, just off the top of my head, would probably comprise about 25%. Of our portfolio.
Of the entire portfolio?
Yes.
Okay.
But that's grown from a cost base of about 15%. So, you know, if we look at it in terms of cost base, it's about 15%.
Mm-hmm.
But by value, or market value, it's 25%. You know, we think or we believe that good opportunities are rare. And, you know, they really should be, you know, compelling opportunities should be weighted appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes no sense to us, at least, you know, why you would, I guess, for example, hold a very diverse portfolio just for the market exposure. You know, if I wanted to achieve market beta, I'd go out and buy an index future because that's the cheapest way to express it. Yeah, and so I think good company opportunities, compelling opportunities are rare, which is why we you know, invest with such conviction and it's concentration. Yeah.
We're taught to, since a very early age, we're taught to buy low and sell high.
Mm-hmm.
And almost by definition, that means that we sell our winners.
Yeah.
Whereas some evidence seems to suggest that we should back our winners. Those are the positions that we should follow. So it's... Yeah. Great to see you have the conviction.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to our trade process. You know, we prefer to scale into things to reduce our risk and scale out of things to take money off the table when we think sort of, you know, an appropriate value has been reached.
Mm-hmm. So is that, I suppose, that's your self-discipline then? You start to trim positions when they hit your estimate of intrinsic value?
Yes, to a degree. I guess the real question is how do you calculate intrinsic value, and what method do you use to calculate it? Or is there such a, you know, could you really say value is intrinsic? Because it would obviously vary depending on what methodology you use. Mm. So, you know, we just like to think of things in terms of how the business is actually operating itself, and we try to sort of isolate risks, you know, really be aware of what particular risks the business is exposed to more than anything. So as long as the business is tracking well, you know, and not subject to any sort of externalities as far as we can gauge, then we're happy to sort of be along for the journey as long as everything is tracking in the right direction.
Okay, so I imagine the holding period on some of the positions, or at least your investment horizon, would be quite lengthy.
It just really depends on what bucket or silo the opportunity falls into.
Mm-hmm.
the example of a past position I can give you is the Reject Shop. So we purchased it. That was during the time of when Amazon was entering Australia and was going to put all retailers out of business. So we ended up purchasing the Reject Shop in the around the mid $3 range from memory. And that was well under, you know, the NTA on their books, or they claimed NTA. And that was, we treated that more as a mean reversion play. And we ended up getting out of that particular stock, I think, in the mid to high sevens. So we made very good money on it. But it was just a matter of sort of buying it cheaply, holding it for, you know, a certain period when the market started to recognize its value. And once it started to trade up there, which was sort of a little bit over NTA, we thought, okay, the thesis has played out. So it's time for us to get out of it slowly, yeah.
So would, in that case, you're using NTAs, I suppose, a yardstick.
I should say in that particular instance, it wasn't NTA that we used as a primary measure of value. It was more the cash flow multiple. Which was, so from memory, I think it was trading at about a 3x cash multiple at $3.50. And then obviously, once it had risen, it was trading at a much higher multiple.
Okay. So I suppose a dyed-in-the-wool value investor would perhaps run a discounted cash flow analysis and maybe provide that reference point with some sort of comparables. So is that, in this instance, it seems more like that was a comparables type of position. You looked at relatively what it was worth?
Well, it's more a matter of, for example, if I was to go out and privatize the Reject Shop at that valuation, which could have been a possibility given, you know, our AUM, would it make sense from that sort of perspective as a PE sort of play? And that's how I really thought about that. And if you've got a, you know, if you're buying at a cash multiple of 3x, that's a cash yield of a bit over 30%. You know, debt is cheap at the moment. How much equity would be required to take it over at that valuation? You know, so it was compelling from that opportunity.
That's interesting. Most people probably wouldn't look at it through that lens. Whereas you have the ability to do so, I suppose. So that's great. It's great insight into your valuation process. So how much of the portfolio do you allocate to shares?
We use a dynamic approach, so we don't have any constraints whatsoever. You know, I'm talking about in the sense of our private portfolio, not the, the fund itself has position limits, but privately we're unconstrained. I suppose at the moment we'd probably have about maybe 30% equity exposure at the moment.
Okay, and that's all Australian.
So we're purely invested in the local market because we find it a little bit easier to manage FX risk and or not have exposure to that FX risk.
One thing that I'm interested to know is, with your team as it is today, how do you filter, or how do you get ideas across, you know, all assets that you invest in?
So we have relationships with a large number of debt syndicators, so we get access to a lot of deal flow, basically. So in a month, we'd typically see at least 4 to 5 opportunities a month, I'd say. So that gives us a lot of insight into what's happening in the market, and, you know, we hold all that information on a database so we can tell, you know, virtually within, you know, 15 minutes whether we like the deal or whether we don't. So, and we've developed a really good reputation in the market that we can put up, you know, significant clips of money in very short notice. I think the quickest we put up money, I think, is almost same day, to be honest, for one of our deals.
Same day.
You know, typically we privately we hold, you know, a decent amount of cash at any one time. Typically, not always, but we like to sort of keep that option open. If something we really like comes, pops up, then we're able to participate in it.
How long, what, typically, how long do you invest in this position?
We try and control our duration to sort of mitigate interest rate risk. So we tend to like facilities that are under 12 months. So we really control our duration risk. And
when you are assessing these opportunities, you obviously, there's micro factors that we take into account. Or you would take into account, such as the project itself, the terms. But do you also take into account the macro environment? In Melbourne, and indeed in many capital cities around Australia at the moment, we're seeing substantial supply of, say, apartment buildings and townhouses and that type of thing. And there's concerns around, severe price depreciation, potential bankruptcies with builders, that type of thing. Can you explain how you mitigate those risks and the terms of the deals, I suppose, in any broad sense?
Yeah, so we have deep industry links, or we maintain deep industry links. So, and that runs across, you know, market participants at every level in every capacity. So we are able to virtually pick up the phone to anyone in the industry and find out what's going on. If that's sort of part of our due diligence process. So I think that is a real advantage for us. And that's what sort of separates us. It's almost like an edge, being able to call, you know, a big commercial builder and say, okay, do you think this is appropriate for a construction estimate? Do you think the facility will be enough? Yes or no? What's wrong with this? So I think that provides us a really good broad advantage, and being able to sort of call these principals of the firms directly is a real advantage for us.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think in a previous conversation you've said to me that, and this will provide context for the listeners, that it's just like a mortgage on a house. If you're the first creditor to take control of the property if things go really badly. So is that primarily how you see risk? That's the worst case. And has that ever happened? Have you ever had to, I suppose, I don't even know what the term is, but take control of premises?
The term is foreclose, and no, we haven't.
Okay.
We tend to be pretty good at picking out the projects that we don't think stack up or make sense. Of course, having that market intel is really beneficial from that side. And there are lots of tools out there that are freely available to the public as well, you know, in terms of, you know, whether, you know, the end product is priced, you know, at a realistic figure. So we look at all those sort of factors as well. And it's all sort of freely available to the investing public, as well. And now that you mentioned the first mortgage, so you can also invest in debt depending on the facility at different levels. And, you know, that's, we judge that according to first principles, as we mentioned. So everything goes back there, down to that. You know, for first, if we're getting, say, 10% on a first mortgage, then the second mortgage should be a lot higher. And, you know, you work off that.
In a recent letter, you talked about funding in the marketplace, the big banks particularly. Before the GFC, I believe the number you had was around about 60%. They were throughout the commercial real estate debt markets. And then we saw that spike a few years ago, but now we've seen that come off, and you expect that to continue. Why do you think that, why are they pulling out? And I suppose, well, does that create an opportunity for you?
Yes, well, it's a simple supply and demand equation, I think. I think you're making reference, I think pre-GFC, banks are funding, I think, about 60% of the commercial development space, and that had risen as high as 85% or thereabouts, and that's down. I think it's sitting at about 75% at the moment. But I think that will continue tapering down because of the entrance of new players in the market. For example, the commercial development space in the US is significantly lower. I think that, you know, just off the top of my head, is sits at about 30%. I'm not saying that it will become like that in Australia, but, you know, it's a very broad market. And, yeah, so if the banks drop 5%, that's still a huge opportunity for private investors out there.
When I read that in the letter, I thought that that was potentially a concerning sign, but if that creates opportunities for other lenders to come into the market, then I suppose these developments are still going to go ahead, and builders are going to be able to source capital. Investing in shares, Australian and international, is probably enough for me in terms of my intellectual capacity. So I'm interested to know, where do you feel you fundamentally add value to the investment process?
I think across the whole board.
Okay.
You know, I think being a generalist with strong technical skills has its advantages, and being able to compare opportunities across different asset classes is really valuable. For example, if, you know, someone who only invested in equities is only able to compare equities against equities, but not compare returns at the equity level against, you know, higher up in the capital structure, I think that really affects the ability to analyze those equity opportunities accurately. I think that's, I guess, where a lot of our value lies, and being able to accurately assess the risk return characteristics of our investments.
It's very difficult for people to, for retail investors anyhow, to move further up that the capital structure, or to you know, to be in a position to invest in bond markets or debt at any small scale.
But, saying that, it can be done at the retail level via listed bonds or hybrids.
Okay.
An example I can give you is I think at the start of 2016, we had quite a significant investment in Seven Group hybrids, the Telly's 4 instrument. And the face value on those hybrids is $100. And we picked them up sort of at an average price of about $65. At that price, it was you had a running yield of about 12%, or a little bit over 12%, fully franked distributions.
Oh, wow.
And so that was quite a good opportunity, because you had, you know, capital upside, but you had a very strong running yield as well. And so, yeah, recently we sold out of those in sort of the mid-$90 range with the latest conversion proposal that's been put forth. So we've achieved, you know, very strong return over our hold period of 2 and a bit years. And yeah, but
so there's definitely a market, you would say, for retail investors if they're willing.
Correct. It's just about, I guess, broadening you know, their hunt beyond equities. There's plenty of listed stuff available in the fixed income space.
I'd like to just discuss the managed fund. It's currently, it's not open to retail investors. It's
just a wholesale fund at the moment. And a big part of that comes down to liquidity. From my understanding, with retail funds, liquidity requirements are significantly higher. You have to be able to offer daily liquidity, I think, in most cases. And but part of our investment strategy is to be paid for taking upon the risks of investing in illiquid assets.
And so it doesn't lend itself to...
I don't think it lends itself easily. It probably could be done, but it's not our focus at the moment.
I suppose that's just another headache, isn't it? For those who don't know what we mean by liquidity, being able to, as a retail investor, get your money in and out as quickly as possible. But if you're investing in illiquid assets, that's obviously another thing that you have to deal with, the flows. Okay. This is one, I suppose, final point here that I think would be of real interest to our listeners, is your efforts, your philanthropic endeavours, and I suppose that giving back. Can you explain what your family is trying to achieve here?
I suppose it all stems primarily from my mother, who, as I've articulated, is quite a selfless sort of person, being active in helping the community and sort of giving privately donations to various charitable causes.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity to set up the foundation was really a way to structure that. And, you know, foundation donations are made just to Australian charities and
mm-hmm. Is there a particular causes. Focus?
Yeah, so typically on alleviating homelessness and, you know, child poverty.
Mm-hmm.
We give to sort of medical research as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's in addition to her you know, private donations.
Mm. No, I think that's wonderful.
Overseas. So yeah, it's been a good experience for us in the sense of really thinking about, you know, how the funds will be, or the donations will be used most efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And how we'll get to those in need now, you know, rather than a year or two down the track. I think, you know, there's a real need for, you know, charity in society.
Mm.
And we focus on helping people immediately rather than...
Because there's obviously, I suppose, one argument is that can be made is if you have the ability to invest money and compound that relatively well,
mm-hmm.
that the money's perhaps better off in your hands for a substantial period of time
mm-hmm.
rather than delivering those funds now.
Mm-hmm.
So just to confirm, does a portion of the profit from the managed fund go to the charitable trust that you've set up?
Yes, so we will be donating a portion of profits mm-hmm. To the charitable fund. We haven't, you know, determined whether it's going to be a fixed amount, but we would probably say that it would be a low double-digit figure at this point.
Yeah, great. I mean,
over time, yeah.
The fund's relatively new, but...
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be great to see that play out over time.
Yeah. So I think that is, you know, we consider that just doing our bit,
mm-hmm.
and we feel that it'll be used beneficially, then mm-hmm. it'll be good.
Yeah, great. Okay, so if people want to learn more about you and about DAP Family Office and the DAP Capital Group, where can they go?
The best place to go would be our website. It's dat.com.au,
mm-hmm.
and that provides sort of a broad overview of what we do. You can request for more details through that.
Great. And my favourite and final question is if you could go back in time and tell a younger you something about finance, money or investing, what would it be?
I don't think I'd change anything on, because as I said before, you know, we're, you know, the person we are today is, we're a sum of all our experiences and,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've got a very happy, satisfying life at the moment and I wouldn't change that for anything.
Well, that's great to know.
Yeah.
And, Manuel, thank you for your time today.
Yeah.
And, I look forward to chatting to you again soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Owen.
Thanks again for tuning into the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.